Anya sat in the warm, bubbly water, tiny waves sloshing with the slight motions of her body as she kept the book braced open against her drawn-up knees. Photographic specialist Rahim Al-Hajj had lent her a copy of Plato's Dialogues, well-grimed and dog-eared by the team, as she had taken her leave of the recovery site late that afternoon. Unwinding in her hotel room after dinner in one of her favorite fashions, she was reading what Plato had written about Atlantis. The legend claimed there had been an island outside the Pillars of Heracles, larger than Libya and Asia put together. The Atlanteans, the story said, made war on Europe. The Athenians, eventually standing alone, had defeated them. Then violent earthquakes had occurred, followed by floods. In a single day and night, the island of Atlantis and all of its people had disappeared in the depths of the sea. That sounded pretty final to Anya. It did intrigue her that the Athenians apparently suffered greatly from the same catastrophe. This part was often left out when people were told the myth of the lost continent. The story claimed that Atlantis had been built by the sea god Poseidon to impress his human love, Clyto. It was a land of fertile fields, concentric circles of canals, elephants, and other such wonders. Anya made note of several of these details to take up with her hosts in the morning. Perhaps the most impressive and amazing Atlantean characteristic was the 9,000-year interval since its supposed fall. She put her book up on the rim of the tub and closed her eyes, trying to wrap her mind around it. As someone who had studied geology and a bit of paleontology as part of her formal education, she had little trouble coping with 9 millennia. In geologic terms, it was a fraction of a second. But for a coherent account of events to survive for 9,000 years, for any kind of knowledge to be transmitted over such a yawning gulf of time, was truly jaw-dropping. Anya was well aware that archaeology, especially the relatively new but fruitful practice of applying modern forensic techniques to archaeological evidence, was showing that as often as not, the written histories bore only a passing resemblance to what could be physically demonstrated to have happened. History in general was hardly bunk, but to say it was inexact was like saying it snows at the North Pole. It was doubtful to Anya that any meaningful, let alone accurate, information could be transmitted over 9,000 years, and yet the legend of Atlantis had persisted all that time. It had held a grip on the human imagination continuously since Plato had recorded it. Anya shook her head. Weariness was getting the better of her. She'd been going pretty hard of late, to say the least. She stood up, sending a cascade of soapy foam down her long, smooth body and legs, and drew the curtain around the tub to shower off before heading to bed. Anya spent the following day down in the excavation pit itself, painstakingly helping to extract burned scrolls from the rubble of the burned cabinets. Now she was exhausted and sticky from sweat, although here in the main lab inside the old warehouse it was quite cool. Apparently, the Supreme Council on Antiquities was willing to spring for air conditioning. She noticed Yaja lurking off to one side. She wore schoolgirl blue and white, with knee-high white stockings instead of the thigh-highs she'd had on the day before. Her revealing skirt went only half down her thighs. The girl fanned herself with a sheaf of fan-folded paper and eyed a handsome young Egyptian technician working on a computer near her. He was either shy or deliberately ignoring her. They made eye contact, exchanged a glare, then both looked away. Anya turned her own attention towards Pilatovsky, who sat on a stool beside her, pretending not to notice.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't the Minoan civilization destroyed by a great big volcanic eruption around 1500 BC?
Yes, Anya. The catastrophic eruption of Terra. It is now estimated to have been at least 10 times as powerful as Krakatoa in 1883. Although geologists tend to date the eruption from about 1600 BC, that volume of ejecta would be the same magnitude as the terrible Tambora eruption of 1815, the most violent of recorded history, just one point on the volcanic explosivity scale beneath supervolcano.
So it would have made a royal mess of much of the Aegean? I mean, the way the catastrophe that destroyed Atlantis is supposed to have.
If you're implying that perhaps Atlantis and the Minoan culture of Crete were the same, then it is indeed a common suspicion many people have come to over the years.
Somebody should tell her that we have found many references on the scrolls that make it impossible for the writer to be referring to Minoans.
Burly, good-natured Dr. Pilatovsky looked warily at Yadja, giving Anya the impression that she wasn't the only one who found the brilliant language expert a problem child.
From contextual evidence found in the translations of these Atlantis scrolls, it is clear that they were written about a half a century after Solon. That would make them a century older than Plato's writing.
Anya was still skeptical about serious archaeologists accepting Atlantis as fact, though she had to admit that none of them actually seemed to be vested in the scroll's authenticity. Still, there was no mistaking the excitement that ran through the site whenever the gong went off to announce that they had developed more images of restored fragments.
One thing that puzzles me when reading Plato, I didn't see any talk about advanced technology. At least, nothing like what people always talk about, with flying machines and artificial light and so on.
In fact, Atlantean association with technological progress seems to have first appeared in a book called A Dweller on Two Planets by Frederick Oliver. It came out in the late 19th century, after Oliver claimed to have received the information in dreams. What can I say? He was from California.
Somebody ought to tell her that the new scrolls substantiate much of what Frederick Oliver wrote in that book.
I do not know that I would go so far as to say substantiate, but nonetheless, we must admit we find certain correspondences. Ever since our excavation of this site began, we have had to wonder if some alternate account of Atlantis might have surfaced sporadically throughout history. Perhaps without impinging on academic scholarship, Oliver was able to get hold of it somehow.
Now, with all due respect, that seems to be reaching a bit far.
Not quite as far as believing that he channeled it.
I suppose.
Anya looked sidelong at Yadja. The young woman posed a conundrum. Anya wasn't used to evoking knee-jerk hostility in people she hadn't met, and it bothered her. Considering that she led an isolated enough existence, she couldn't help but feel threatened by such unprovoked, vehement negativity. It was as if she had suddenly been found to be invalid and unworthy for human companionship. Anya knew that cryptology was no soft science, and it involved some of the most abstruse and demanding math around. Perhaps it was Yadja's rigorous training in this discipline that forced her to cling to the role of true believer, whether it came to simple addition or the mystery of Atlantis. She wasn't the first person Anya had bumped up against who harbored both serious scientific credentials and crackpot beliefs. She sometimes suspected that really high-level scientists could only be expected to be sane and knowledgeable in their own field of expertise, leaving them otherwise as ignorant as anyone else in society. Perhaps Yadja's hostility arose from antipathy toward the role Anya played, authentically enough, of house skeptic and foil to Christy Chatham. Anya had certainly suffered her share of flame attacks from such antagonists before she quit visiting the show's message boards, but even the most virulent rant couldn't spill out of cyberspace and into her face the same way one icy glance from Yadja could.
Pilatovsky, why didn't Ismail want Yadja to touch the computer yesterday?
I kill computers!
How? With a sledgehammer?
Just by touching!
It is true. We cannot let her handle anything electronic. In seconds,
it has to do with my personal magnetic field. It disrupts electronic devices.
I don't buy that. Things like that don't happen in the real world.
Lend me your cell phone.
Only two of the team members were on duty in the excavation pit. A short, stocky Polish man named Tadeusz, and a willowy Egyptian woman a head taller named Hadita, who wore what looked like a ruby in her pierced left nostril. The pair had trouble communicating verbally, since neither's English was the strongest. To make matters worse, Tadeusz was hard of hearing, yet the two worked well together, somehow having developed an effective means of nonverbal communication. Everyone tacitly assumed they were sleeping together, although they never seemed to seek each other out off hours. The consensus held that this was a cunning ruse. As their shift ended, Tadeusz and Hadita dropped their tools and strolled in exhaustion up the ramp to the exit of the bubble-domed structure. Tadeusz pushed the wood-framed door open and strode out into the night. A few bright lights shone randomly from the nearby buildings, casting jagged patterns of light and shadow across the demolition rubble. The two breathed in deeply as they approached the door of the converted warehouse. Hadita smiled into the night, looking forward to a few hours of hard-earned rest. Now, as she pushed through the entrance to the expedition's headquarters, she was just a few minutes away.